People will talk. Welcome to another episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me today is Maria.
No.
And a very special guest, Alvaro. Alvaro, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much, Enda. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure, Alvaro. And we will get to know you. Our listeners will at least over the next 30 minutes or so. But to start off this part, you are from Zamora. You're a teacher and also you're an editor of a magazine. Is this a fair summing up of Alvaro the man, or have I left something out?
No, I think it's very, very fair. Yeah, that's basically in very broad strokes a fair introduction.
Of course, people who have listened to our podcast for a while, they know myself and Maria both have our background in teaching as well. Maria, you left teaching behind a few years ago. How do you feel about that decision?
Should I give you a real answer? I'm quite happy myself. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's good and bad things, but I'm quite happy myself.
Well, it's not actually entirely true that you left it behind, because you might have left ESL teaching behind, but you will become a Bollywood teacher in the near future.
Let's not go into that, because we have Alvaro to tell us lots of exciting things.
No, that was very interesting, Maria, please.
while we're at it, I might as well start asking my question, which is, it's actually about the place that you're from. Which is Zamora for our listeners. We're just going to give you the full Zeta for the pronunciation. This is an interesting, very interesting place. I think from my point of view, well, obviously I'm biased because I'm from León, so it's very close with neighbors. lots of cultural links there. But for the benefit of our listeners, I'll say that there's a very famous saying in Spanish, which is kind of like the equivalent of Rome wasn't built in a day, which involves Zamora. Is that right, Alvaro?
It is. Zamora no se tomó en una hora. Like Zamora wasn't taken in an hour. And that is making reference to the siege. There was a very, very, very famous siege in the Middle Ages. And of course, because of the city walls that were very, very high, very, very well protected, it took, I think, months to take the city. So, there you go.
Very interesting to see. So, like, Zamora is, like, as big as Rome. So, you know, a lot to say. So, can you tell us a bit more about it? Like, you know.
Zamora, the town, is located in this big plateau by one of the main rivers of Spain. It is encircled by walls, medieval walls. And it's got a lot of history because there's a lot of Romanesque style churches, and we have a lot of natural attractions for tourists as well, like birds, mammals, forests, mountains, plateaus, caves. So we have a mix between the historical and the natural, which is quite rich.
Very nice. Then you make a good rep for the tourist board.
Alvaro, I was just going to say, I know another person from Zamora who is very well read, like yourself. So is there something in the water there that makes people particularly cultured?
That's a very good question. Because you see, in Zamora we have several famous major poets in Spanish, in the Spanish language. And I think we have these breathing grounds for writers. It's really funny, really. In fact, we have we made a new bridge, and they called it the Poet's Bridge. You see how wow. important literature is for the town and the area itself.
I was going to ask you about your relationship with literature and writing. I was going to ask you, was this or has it been a lifelong thing? But it would seem from your answer there that it has been, by virtue of the fact where you come from. Has that been your biggest influence?
I wouldn't say so, no. That has been there. As a kind of a soil to live in, on, at, if you want. But no, my literary awakening actually happened during my university years. It was due to studying modern 20th century poetry. Mainly the American classics, you know, like Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Allen Ginsberg for me is a classic, and the kind of people. So, I did not start reading literature as literature, because I read a lot before for pleasure, of course, until then. And I started writing at that point as well. I remember that I started writing poetry and comics for punk magazines, well, punk fanzines, really. And that was really the start for me.
Very nice.
Yeah, sorry, Maria, I've cut across you there. Please continue, Bollywood teacher.
Well, I was going to ask more about the teaching thing. It seems that because I'm not a teacher anymore, I'm sort of like very keen on asking more about ESL teaching, you know, see what it's like still. But it was just coming to mind, you know, when you were talking about how you like literature and all these things that you picked an interest in. Well, now you're teaching, but then, you know, kind of like when you're teaching, I remember that you sort of course you want to make the students interested in what they're doing, but you know, you have so many classes that you kind of like also want to kind of like do what you really like and you know, sort of use materials and things that you like so that you can enjoy too and explore those things. So do you find any opportunities to actually use, you know, the literature that you like in class, or is that not an option for you?
Actually, I have to admit that I have tried to introduce literature in my C1 classes in the advanced level, and I have failed miserably. It is terrible. I compiled a set of poems. In fact, I think I have it somewhere here. Yes, it is. I called it classical literature reading material, extra reading material, and it included Shakespeare, William Blake, Shelley, Yeats, Ezra Pound, Dylan Thomas, Allen Ginsberg, and Carol Ann Duffy. I told the students, I asked them to write a review of one of the poems, and like I remember one person actually wrote a review about the most simple of those poems. So no, I have to confess I failed miserably at that. I have in fact tried to introduce literature obliquely, if you want, by way of working on rhyming.
Right.
So yes, like in the class, of course, you have to deal with phonetics, and phonetics are linked to rhyme, obviously. So by asking the students to play games with words that rhyme, and just making up these very, very silly, very, very nonsensical poems, I think I have introduced somehow a more playful way of dealing with English language, or maybe a problem.
Nice.
And it's not just the English language, Alvaro, because the first time I ever met you was at a Sinterklaas party, Dutch celebration of Christmas, more or less, and you surprised me by speaking Irish. Do you remember this?
I kind of remember that. I do not remember speaking Irish, and it was probably something like, hello, good day, how are you? Something basic like that.
Well, no, it's amazing because you also have said, if I'm not mistaken, you were one of the first people to set up an Irish language exchange in Madrid. Is that correct?
I was the first one to do that after a big gap, let's say. There was a more lively one in the 90s. In the 90s, the Irish department of the official school of languages here in Madrid, it was huge, like literally huge. There was loads of students. They organized these crazy parties, and of course they had a language exchange night. But it decayed, and I think it was in 2018 or 2017, I can't remember the year. Yes, I did set up these new conversation exchange circle. I think that they're still doing that because I became a bit, it was impossible for me to keep up with all the languages. Yeah. Practice and nothing, but I think they're still doing that in some bars in Madrid.
I think there's a fascinating thing, this connection to the Irish language, because of course for most Irish people that would be surprising, because we barely speak it ourselves. So when a foreigner speaks it, it's a great thing. But you mentioned before punk zines. You mentioned Allen Ginsberg and his very particular style of beat poetry. So does Irish fit in into these other areas of your literary life, or is it something that stands apart very interestingly and beautifully, but apart, or does it actually slot in surprising ways to your other influences and inspirations?
Okay, the first time I heard Irish or listened to Irish, I think this is going to be very, very, very familiar to you, was when I was listening to Enya.
Ah, okay.
Again, back in the 90s. And I thought, okay, this is not English. This is magical. This is amazing. I really love the sounds. But since then, because my level of Irish hasn't really reached any heights, I can't really say that I have been able to absorb it or incorporate it into my creative output of sorts, which is a shame, really. But I think my biggest achievement is that once I had a dream in Irish.
Oh, wow.
Can we ask what it was about? Or?
I honestly do not remember. It was something about there was a bus and a bus station, and that's all I can remember. But it was in Irish.
What was Enya in your dream?
No, she was not there. I wouldn't know that.
So we will, of course, talk a lot about you being an editor, because you have published three very high quality zines. But I want to focus just for a moment on the writing aspect of your life as well. Do you still write as much as you used to, or is that subservient now to your editing role? And if that is the case, do you miss writing? Or if you do write, continue to write as much as you did in the past, do you have a specific routine for your writing? You know, you always write in the morning or at midnight burning the candle, you know?
Yes, I'm more of a midnight kind of writer. But for a very practical reason, which is around midnight, about between 12 and 1, it is when Madrid is the quietest. And I really need silence to write. Because most of the things I write, which is poetry, is derived from silence. From the way I understand silence, it affects me. It affects my perception of the world, and how it reveals new worlds inside the night and the silence. It's a bit pedestrian to try to explain it, I think. But yes, most of it is related to the night or fueled by night, at least. Sometimes I write walking. Walking is very, very good for letting your thoughts spread out in a million different ways. I would say both are mostly my two techniques.
Do you know of any writers who were also very prodigious in the wee hours of the night?
I have no idea.
I'm gonna Google it here. Allen Ginsberg, so there, Charles Dickens, Carolyn Duffy, who you mentioned as well, mm-hmm. and Pablo Neruda and Robert Frost were some of the writers who, for various reasons, I imagine, also liked the cloak of night for their writing pursuits. So there, you're in good company, Alvaro.
Well, thank you very much. I really hope some of that will rub off eventually.
So moving a little bit onto your whole zine thing, well, maybe you want to explain a little bit about because obviously every year you publish a literary zine, don't you, and you focus on kind of like a different idea. So I believe like one has focused on the universe, and you've had crustaceans, which is quite a surprising theme, but very interesting. I think video games are also going to feature there. How do you go about choosing these themes? Is it a case of, you know, these are things that interest you? You know, are there things that come to mind at midnight? I don't know, crustaceans. Is it something like that comes to mind when you're, you know, in silence?
No. there's a lot of ideas I have for zines. And I write them in notebooks, on my phone, everywhere. But then only a very, very few of them are picked eventually. Now, what I want to do with these zines is, and the main goal of my micro-publishing house is, basically, I want to shed beauty on things that are kind of forgotten or unorthodox, if you want. It's like I want to give the reader the sense that they're looking at something and finding a new way of understanding it. You see, I want to look at the world in a more lyrical manner, and I think beauty and mystery and a sense of wonder, they can be found everywhere, really, if you look close enough. So that's what I want to do with these zines. I mean, the night sky doesn't really need me to say it's beautiful, obviously. But invertebrates, I think lots of people loathe them for very superstitious reasons. And the next one, which is basically a mix between psychogeography, walking, really, and video games. I really consider that video games can be very restrictive, but also that we can find a lot of interesting parts in video games, mainly locations and environments. Some of them are really, really lush, really full of life. And I wanted to place the looking glass on them.
So you mentioned the beauty, and that does fit into what, you know, we could characterize your zines as having, this poetic prose and sense of wonder. You also mentioned psychogeography. So for our listeners at the back, who aren't the brightest, how would you describe this to them, psychogeography?
Well, psychogeography is, nobody knows what it really is because it cannot really be defined as such, but some people have said that it is simply an exploration of space in which you pay attention to the feelings that are created because of the elements of the space while you traverse it. Psychogeography was kind of born as a current with the situationist movement in Paris in the 1960s. So it is linked to leftist avant-garde movements. It was kind of political in the past. To me, it is definitely not political, but to me, it is a very interesting way of discovering and unearthing new visions of the city. You see, because when we move around the city, we just go from point A to point B, usually in a very, very straight fashion. But psychogeography wants to say, okay, why don't you go to C first, then to D, and then maybe to B if you feel like it, and see what happens. See what emotions, what thoughts arise. And this is very, very interesting because I think it is a bit like painting new ideas with a canvas formed on your mind. See, it's a very experimental thing you have to do by walking, which mixes also movement and physical exercise. And I think it's a very healthy way of reappropriating the city.
You mentioned something interesting about it being prior a leftist ideology. Yeah. My impression, I've never really studied this in depth, so there could be a lot of holes in this theory, but you can tell me what you think. But a lot of these avant-garde and daring and these styles that break the mold, essentially, are often, at least for me, left-wing. I don't know, is that how you would see it as well? I mean, are left-wing artists usually the ones changing the game?
In general terms, I would say it has been historically the case. There have been some avant-garde related to the right spectrum of politics, such as, you know, futurism with Marinetti and Vorticism with Erzsébet. But mostly it has been the left side of the spectrum pushing the envelope in artistic terms. Mainly, I think, because the right tends to be more conservative and more traditional, and the left has been searching other paths, other ways of explaining the world. With this, I'm not saying, of course, that left or right is better in terms of literary achievement. No, that doesn't make any sense, of course. But it certainly has been the avant-garde leftist ones who have actually created these interesting movements. Take, for example, Surrealism, Dada, et cetera, they have all been linked to revolutionary ideas.
Yeah, myself and Maria, a few years ago, we went to the MAPRE Center, and we saw a side-by-side exhibition of Civil War photographs from two photographers. One was a lefty, the other was a conservative or a supporter of Franco. And leaving aside whatever you think of the left or the right in this particular conflict, just objectively, I would say we found that the photographs from the conservative photographer were very flat, very uninspired, and in some cases mean. And what I mean to say by that is that they're very exploitative. There's somebody maybe in not a perhaps a comfortable situation, and there's a photograph taken of that. But by contrast, the left, this photographer, It's been a few years, so I can't give names at this moment, but it's been on a previous podcast. The leftist, it was just a much better style. The photos popped with that X quality. It just seemed like there was framing, there was a sense of space, there was a sense of how to actually put the photograph together while also capturing what was happening. It was a wonderful blend of narrative style, I guess, but also recording the historical truth as well. But again, as you said, it's not to say, of course, that one side or the other has a better literary output or artistic output over the centuries. And speaking of this kind of culture stuff as well, I believe Maria has a question she wants to ask you. She's raising her hand. The camera is off. She's raising her hand for her turn.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of questions I want to ask, but they're accumulating, otherwise I'll forget. Well, you've mentioned like so many influences, and not just, you know, from literature, really from all fields. And I suppose at the end of the day, all creative industries are kind of like related somehow, no? And they take inspiration from each other. But in this particular zine, the next one that is coming out, I believe is influenced by writers like Baudelaire, Sinclair, mm-hmm. other writers like that. So you've already mentioned kind of like, you know, how themes like walking and silence have inspired. Funnily enough, and I found out some of the people that you actually enjoyed reading the most. What do you think is the key to the success, you know, the permanent success of this kind of style?
I'm going to say that if we take, for example, Baudelaire that you mentioned, and Sinclair, Ian Sinclair, and another we call Flaneur, I think that the main point of them is that they strive to rediscover reality in a sense that is quite radical. Baudelaire, of course, I think you know him. He wrote poetry about the flowers of evil, about prostitutes, sickness, death, and he did this while keeping a very, very, very traditional meter, which is the sonnet. So immediately you see these juxtaposition of very, very classical meter, very classical forms, and the topic itself, which caused, of course, an uproar in France at the moment. But it is the rediscovering, the reshifting of the gaze from the traditionally respected themes of beauty that we had in that society at the moment, to a wider array of themes that is, I think, from my perspective, the biggest appeal for Baudelaire. I think Ian Sinclair, he does something quite like that, in the sense that he's one of the most prominent writers of sex geography. He goes through London and he tries to shift the gaze of our normal understanding of the city by means of understanding first its history, its connections, the people who live there, etc. So I think that the main appeal of these writers is the breaking of new realities. Or the reshifting of these entire outlook on our physical material space.
It's very interesting because it links to what you said before, no, about all the thing about psychogeography and kind of like how even like when you're used to walking a certain way and for whatever reason you take a different route one day, mm-hmm. it kind of like you start seeing everything in a different way on you and sort of notice things that you haven't seen and even feel different. So it's definitely a huge thing to explore there and very original to link it to video games. So looking forward to that.
Thanks.
So just to finish up with our last question, and since it's the last question, we'll make it a double header. So this is specifically about editing. You mentioned Baudelaire caused uproar, and it is true that he wrote letters to his mother even saying, look, I don't care about the uproar. This is what I wanted to say, and I'm not doing anything particularly wrong in what I say. So the first part of that question I want to ask you is, as an editor yourself, have you ever been in that situation where a writer has presented something to you that has been scandalous? And if it hasn't happened, what would you do in such a situation? If it's literally, or is it literary, as a literary piece, it's quite good and says something maybe perhaps valuable, but on the other hand, maybe it's offensive for some group or in some way. That must be an editor's nightmare, I imagine, no?
A proper editor maybe would have problems with that, but rather I'm just a zine, a fanzine editor. So the point of fanzines of zines is that you have literal absolute freedom to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. The only boundary really is the budget, which tends to be quite scarce. But no, if I found something really interesting but kind of shocking, and of course, bear in mind that these days it is very, very, very hard to shock anyone.
Mm-hmm.
At least me. I'm not very easily shocked or scared or anything, really. I would definitely publish it if I had the right project for it. You see, this summer, while reading all the submissions, I did encounter a couple of poems that people sent me that were very, very interesting. I could not publish them in this upcoming fanzine because thematically they were not related. But I definitely told the writers, please, I want to keep in touch with you because this is incredibly interesting. And I think in the future I might find a project just to carry these texts out there, because again, this really surprising, really, really surprising. Offering these imagery I've never seen before, new rhythm. It's a shame that you cannot publish everything you'd like, but again, with such a big budget, it's kind of hard.
And speaking of the budget, as an editor, what do you find the most challenging part of releasing this scene? Is it sending emails maybe to writers where you have to say, sorry, but best luck next time? Is it organizing distribution, getting the illustrations?
Well, I don't have a lot of issues with saying no, mainly because whenever I say no, I give very specific reasons. And for the most part, they belong to the you have not written in the style or about the topic or using the genre adequate category. Mm-hmm. So there's a problem there because I always justify my choices. Editing the texts themselves is a walk in the park because usually they tend to be quite high quality. We only need to modify some commas, some words here and there, maybe a couple of paragraphs, but it's minor, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the distribution of fanzines, that is challenging. Because you have to think that, first, the world of fanzines tends to be quite a bit endogamic. Like, the topics themselves and the people making them, then they are based on this idea of total freedom, of course. But they tend to write fanzines about usually the same topics. So even for people who buy fanzines, our fanzines, the fanzines from Southern Press, this micro publishing house I have, these are a bit alienating since they're written in two languages, Spanish and English. Mm-hmm. And they deal with poetry and poetic prose, which is not something that most people are interested in, as you might be aware of. So the thing is, It is a source of absolute pleasure and joy to go around bookshops and ask the owners or the assistants, hey, can I leave these here with you? I think they're very interesting. You explain the project to them. They're usually very receptive. Some of them say, okay, we're not going to sell them, but leave them here. Some others say, yes, absolutely, that they're very enthusiastic. But again, the welcoming attitude they have towards them is an absolute joy, I have to say. Now, how well they sell, that's a completely different chapter.
Don't worry, we know very much about that as well. how difficult it is to shift copies, but sure, we do it for the love of it anyway at the end of the day. So, Alvaro, another big question we have to ask you as well. You've mentioned some writers that are dear to you. Are there any other writers that you would consider some of your favorites?
Well, yes, there is a big influence in my writing and in my life at large, which is Arthur Machen. I don't know if you've heard about him, Arthur Machen.
I have, yes. Yeah.
Oh, no, fantastic. So, well, yeah. Just for the listeners, he was this the Welsh writer of horror, weird fiction. It's really, really hard to categorize him. But basically, he has been a major influence on my writing and my worldview, because he understood the world as a series of, well, not the world, the experience of a series of ecstatic moments. In fact, he wrote a book called Hieroglyphics, in which he explained his view of good literature. He said that good literature is the one that produces ecstasy in the reader. And he was also a very, very, very avant-garde writer, in the sense that he was a flâneur, a psychogeographer avant la lettre. You know, he started roaming through the streets of London and his native Wales, and recording his experiences and that kind of thing. But it is basically this idea of literature as ecstasy that has informed all my writing and editing and life decisions, really. And of course, poetry in general, I'm definitely more partial to than prose, because of, again, this quality that poetry should also be a sacrament of language. Something elevated, something higher than normal speech, which connects to the idea of ecstasy and walking and understanding the world in a different perspective altogether.
Interesting. So it's amazing that this writer, who maybe doesn't have the biggest coverage or recognition, has such a profound influence on you. And by turn, you know, because I've enjoyed your zines and a lot of people have enjoyed your zines, that indirectly he's also finding an audience through you. Would you see it like that as well?
I would hope so, but no, I cannot aspire to anything written by Machen. His sentences are just masterful. His prose is rumbling, but also poetic and deep. And I could never hope to write or edit anything like anything of his. I mean, there's something I'm really struggling to do, but you know, it's, I suppose, a hope rather than a reality.
You can call to mind a lot of these writers. I imagine that you find that the writers who submit to your zine are also quite well read. So the people that you work with, the poets who send you poems, you can well, you probably chat to them and discover that organically, but you might also see the influences of great poets or great writers in the texts that you see. Is that what happens when you're editing the text and getting submissions?
Not instantly, sorry, because I tend to try to judge them on their own. In fact, I deformat them, print them, and try to judge them as unattachedly as possible. But of course, once you start reading them, some very, very strong influences are obvious. Whether it's again Ian Sinclair for the last one was a big big influence. In poetry, I've read poems directly under the influence of the Romantics, although of course with a modern more modern vocabulary. But of course. Chatting, like you said, with the authors themselves, they always confess these connections. And I think that they're very interesting because even though we are geographically very far away, really, because I've received texts from India, from Chile, from Argentina, South Africa, etc. Literally speaking, we are kind of connected. In a sense, it's kind of fun.
You mentioned you've received letters from all over the world. Is this from people wanting to submit, or also just people who've read the zine and they love it and they want to get in touch with you?
Mostly the first case, because the fanzines, they have a very, very limited distribution, mainly here in Europe, mainly in Spain. I think there's some place in the States, if I'm mistaken. Lots of writers from all across the globe, really, from China, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, India, Pakistan, Africa, lots of countries of Africa, really, mainly from the United States and Britain and Spain. Sadly, because I wanted to have more global vision, because of course the more global you go, the more likely it is that you will have a wider array of very interesting texts. But yes, it's mainly about people sort of submitting texts.
Excellent. So I think, you know, to hacer la pelota, as they say in Spanish, which means the brown nose in English, I'm going to say, Alvaro, you're a Renaissance man.
Yes, because I'm very short. Yes, short.
And regardless of whether you like that title or not, that might be the title of the podcast. No, I'm only joking. But this is by way of me asking, you know, we've covered a lot of ground with you, but is there anything else that's bursting in your chest that you want to tell us while you're on the podcast with us that we haven't had the intellect or imagination to ask you yet?
Well, no. I'm not very good at talking about myself, because I think myself and the things I do are incredibly boring. So I don't. Sorry. I have no imagination for this. I suppose I'd like people to get more into what the fanzine is, what zines are, and poetry and psychogeography and the race and this kind of thing. But of course, this is more to pick the interest of the listeners.
We'll definitely leave a link to your website, which is called Sad Wren, where the listeners can also see previous editions of the zine and also wait feverishly with anticipation for the next one as well, which Maria mentioned already is about video games. Do you have a social media presence, Alvaro?
We do have a Facebook site, but we don't update it very often. We're not really very present on social media, sadly. But I think this ties to the whole concept of Polishing House, which is we're very, very slow, and we do not like rushing, we do not like the immediacy of social media. But we're there. You can also contact us from our website. We have a couple of email addresses you can write us to. So we're not totally out of the world.
Excellent stuff. I'm sure you get a lot of track. I hope you do. I'm a big fan of your zine and what you're trying to do with it. So Alvaro, I have to say it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today on the podcast. It's been so informative, and it's been a real pleasure hearing about your passions, from editing to the writers that you like as well.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's been a real pleasure for me too.
And I'm sure Maria wants to say goodbye as well.
I was just going to thank you then.
Thank you, Maria.
Great stuff. Okay, well, guys, check out Alvaro's website, and we will be back in the next one for our next episode of The People Will Talk podcast.